Chapter 10. The bitter flavor of our interview. I tasted it more and more distinctly, and it was less and less to my taste. "Look here, Mr. Burns," I began very firmly. "You may as well understand that I did not run after this command. It was pushed in my way. I've accepted it. I am here to take the ship home first of all, and you may be sure that I shall see to it that every one of you on board here does his duty to that end. This is all I have to say for the present." He was on his feet by this time, but instead of taking his dismissal he remained with trembling, indignant lips, and looking at me hard as though, really, after this, there was nothing for me to do in common decency but to vanish from his outraged sight. Like all very simple emotional states, this was moving. I felt sorry for him, almost sympathetic, till seeing that I did not vanish, he spoke in a tone of forced restraint. "If I hadn't a wife and a child at home, you may be sure, sir, I would have asked you to let me go the very minute you came on board." I answered him with a matter-of-course calmness, as though some remote third person were in question. "And I, Mr. Burns, would not have let you go. You have signed the ship's articles as chief officer. Until they are terminated at the final port of discharge, I shall expect you to attend to your duty and give me the benefit of your experience to the best of your ability." Stony incredulity lingered in his eyes, but it broke down before my friendly attitude. With a slight upward toss of his arms, I got to know that gesture well afterward, he bolted out of the cabin. We might have saved ourselves that little passage of harmless sparring. Before many days had elapsed, it was Mr. Burns who was pleading with me anxiously not to leave him behind, while I could only return him but doubtful answers. The whole thing took on a somewhat tragic complexion. And this horrible problem was only an extraneous episode, a mere complication in the general problem of how to get that ship which was mine with her appurtenances and her men, with her body and her spirit now slumbering in that pestilential river, how to get her out to sea. Mr. Burns, while still acting captain, had hastened to sign a charter party which in an ideal world without guile would have been an excellent document. Directly I ran my eye over it, I foresaw trouble ahead, unless the people of the other part were quite exceptionally fair-minded and open to argument. Mr. Burns, to whom I imparted my fears, chose to take great umbrage at them. He looked at me with that usual incredulous stare, and said bitterly, "I suppose, sir, you want to make out I've acted like a fool?" I told him, with my systematic kindliness which always seemed to augment his surprise, that I did not want to make out anything. I would leave that to the future. And, sure enough, the future brought in a lot of trouble. There were days when I used to remember Captain Giles with nothing short of abhorrence. His confounded acuteness had let me in for this job, while his prophecy, that I hold, have my hands full coming true, made it appear as if done on purpose, to play an evil joke on my young innocence. Yes, I had my hands full of complications which were most valuable as experience. People have a great opinion of the advantages of experience. But in this connection, experience means always something disagreeable as opposed to the charm and innocence of illusions. I must say I was losing mine rapidly. But on these instructive complications I must not enlarge more than to say that they could all be resumed in the one word. Delay. A mankind which has invented the proverb, "Time is money," will understand my vexation. The word LA entered the secret chamber of my brain, resounded there like a tolling bell which maddens the ear, affected all my senses, took on a black coloring, a bitter taste, a deadly meaning. "I am really sorry to see you worried like this. Indeed, I am." It was the only humane speech I used to hear at that time. And it came from a doctor, appropriately enough. A doctor is humane by definition. But that man was so in reality. His speech was not professional. I was not ill. But other people were, and that was the reason of his visiting the ship. He was the doctor of our legation, and, of course, of the consulate too. He looked after the ship's health, which generally was poor, and trembling, as it were, on the verge of a breakup. Yes, the men ailed. And thus time was not only money, but life as well. I had never seen such a steady ship's company. As the doctor remarked to me, colon, you seem to have a most respectable lot of seamen. Not only were they consistently sober, but they did not even want to go ashore. Care was taken to expose them as little as possible to the sun. They were employed on light work under the awnings. And the humane doctor commended me. Your arrangements appear to me to be very judicious, my dear captain. It is difficult to express how much that pronouncement comforted me. The doctor's round, full face framed in a light-colored whisker was the perfection of a dignified amenity. He was the only human being in the world who seemed to take the slightest interest in me. He would generally sit in the cabin for half an hour or so at every visit. I said to him one day, I suppose the only thing now is to take care of them as you are doing till I can get the ship to sea. He inclined his head, shutting his eyes under the large spectacles, and murmured, the sea. Undoubtedly. The first member of the crew fairly knocked over was the steward, the first man to whom I had spoken on board. He was taken ashore with choleric symptoms, and died there at the end of a week. Then, while I was still under the startling impression of this first home thrust of the climate, Mr. Burns gave up, and went to bed in a raging fever without saying a word to anybody. I believe he had partly fretted himself into that illness. The climate did the rest with the swiftness of an invisible monster ambushed in the air, in the water, in the mud of the river bank. Mr. Burns was a predestined victim. I discovered him lying on his back, glaring sullenly, and radiating heat on one like a small furnace. He would hardly answer my questions, and only grumbled. Couldn't a man take an afternoon off duty with a bad headache for once? That evening, as I sat in the saloon after dinner, I could hear him muttering continuously in his room. Ransom, who was clearing the table, said to me, I am afraid, sir, I won't be able to give the mate all the attention he's likely to need. I will have to be forward in the galley a great part of my time. Ransom was the cook. The mate had pointed him out to me the first day, standing on the deck, his arms crossed on his broad chest, gazing on the river. Even at a distance his well-proportioned figure, something thoroughly sailor-like in his poise, made him noticeable. On nearer view, the intelligent, quiet eyes, a well-bred face, the disciplined independence of his manner made up an attractive personality. When, in addition, Mr. Burns told me that he was the best seaman in the ship, I expressed my surprise that in his earliest prime, and of such appearance, he should sign on as cook on board a ship. It's his heart, Mr. Burns had said. Here's something wrong with it. He mustn't exert himself too much, or he may drop dead suddenly. And he was the only one the climate had not touched, perhaps because, carrying a deadly enemy in his breast, he had schooled himself into a systematic control of feelings and movements. When one was in the secret, this was apparent in his manner. After the poor steward died, and as he could not be replaced by a white man in this oriental port, Ransom had volunteered to do the double work. I can do it all right, sir, as long as I go about it quietly, he had assured me. But obviously he couldn't be expected to take up sick nursing in addition. Moreover, the doctor peremptorily ordered Mr. Burns ashore. With a seaman on each side holding him up under the arms, the mate went over the gangway more sullen than ever. We built him up with pillows in the galley, and he made an effort to say brokenly, now you've got what you wanted, got me out of the ship. You were never more mistaken in your life, Mr. Burns, I said quietly, duly smiling at him, and the trap drove off to a sort of sanatorium, a pavilion of bricks which the doctor had in the grounds of his residence. I visited Mr. Burns regularly. After the first few days, when he didn't know anybody, he received me as if I had come either to gloat over an enemy or else to curry favor with a deeply wronged person. It was either one or the other, just as it happened according to his fantastic sick room moods. Whichever it was, he managed to convey it to me even during the period when he appeared almost too weak to talk. I treated him to my invariable kindliness. Then one day, suddenly, a surge of downright panic burst through all this craziness. If I left him behind in this deadly place, he would die. He felt it, he was certain of it. But I wouldn't have the heart to leave him ashore. He had a wife and child in Sydney. He produced his wasted forearms from under the sheet which covered him, and clasped his fleshless claws. He would die. He would die here. He absolutely managed to sit up, but only for a moment, and when he fell back I really thought that he would die there and then. I called to the Bengal eye dispenser, and hastened away from the room. Next day he upset me thoroughly by renewing his entreaties. I returned an evasive answer, and left him the picture of ghastly despair. The day after I went in with reluctance, and he attacked me at once in a much stronger voice, and with an abundance of argument which was quite startling. He presented his case with a sort of crazy vigor, and asked me finally, how would I like to have a man's death on my conscience? He wanted me to promise that I would not sail without him. I said that I really must consult the doctor first. He cried out at that. The doctor? Never! That would be a death sentence. The effort had exhausted him. He closed his eyes, but went on rambling in a low voice. I had hated him from the start. The late captain had hated him too. Had wished him dead. Had wished all hands dead. What do you want to stand in with that wicked corpse for, sir? He'll have you too, he ended, blinking his glazed eyes vacantly. Mr. Burns, I cried, very much discomposed, what on earth are you talking about? He seemed to come to himself, though he was too weak to start. I don't know, he said languidly. Don't ask that doctor, sir. You are IR sailors. Don't ask him, sir. Someday perhaps you will have a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.